This episode of The Honeydew is brought to you by Helix, Upstart, Honey, and ExpressVPN. More on that later. Let's get into the do.
The Honeydew with Ryan Sickler.
Welcome back to The Honeydew, y'all. We're over here doing it in Studio Nightpants. Ryan Sickler, RyanSickler.com, Ryan Sickler on all social media. Just a huge thank you for all your support. We just finished 100 episodes. We're about to kick off the first of the next 100. So I just want to thank you all for your support. Thank you for making this such a fun show. Thank you for all the messages, the emails, everybody. I sincerely appreciate your support, and we're going to keep on doing the damn thing. So get over, subscribe to the YouTube channel. You'll get audio here on Mondays, video on Tuesdays. Don't just watch, subscribe, and you're going to get some more content coming soon there as well. If you're a fan of the time codes, if you look in the description underneath YouTube, you'll see stories you can jump to if you'd like. The Patreon show is growing. Thank you so much for your support there. The Honeydew with you all. Doing the Honeydew with y'all out there. I've heard some amazing, crazy, funny stories. If you or someone you know has a story that has to be heard, please submit at honeydewpodcast@gmail.com. We're going through all of them. We will get to you. There are a lot. We're going to keep on doing that show too. So if you're on board for it, you can subscribe for a year, save yourself some money. I know that $5 a month is a lot for some people, $60 a year. A lot of things going on out there, but you can subscribe for a year and you'll save over a month of episodes. You'll get them for free. It goes back to you, y'all. So subscribe to that as well. The Facebook fan page, make sure you're subscribed over there for updates, clips, all that stuff. Make sure you're following me on Instagram. Can't thank you guys enough for the iTunes reviews as well. All that stuff helps, man. You guys are the shit. TheHoneydewPodcast.com is the website for the show. All the merch is there. It's also on RyanSickler.com, but the night pants are there. The Night Pant Nation Champion sweats are there. The hoodies, the t-shirts for the Honeydew, the t-shirts for my Ryan Sickler, the fist pump. Fist bump shirt. The Appreciate is really cool design. Upstate merch is the shit. Zach Newton designing some of that stuff for us over there. So thank you. And I record here at the Santa Monica Music Center. You know, I like to give back. So if you live in LA, if you need musical instruments, you need musical lessons, this is the spot for you or your kids. Take a lesson with your kids. Go to santamonicamusic.com. You get online lessons. Use the code Honeydew, and they will waive the registration fee, and they'll give you one free lesson when you sign up for a package. All right? That's the biz. If you're new here on the next 100 shows, what we do over here is we highlight the lowlights. These are the stories behind the storytellers. We're shedding a little light in that darkness and laughing in the face of adversity. And this guy is no stranger to the do. Ladies and gentlemen, excited to have him back. The saga continues. Joey Diaz, welcome back to the Honeydew, Joey. Great to have you here.
What's happening there, Ryan?
I'm saying you look so good.
Great to be here.
Jersey looks good on you.
Trying, brother.
You look like an old suave gangster out of Vegas right now in his twilight years, coming into his own. You look good, dude. You do.
It's tremendous. It's a different life. I got the stink of L.A. off me. My daughter's in school. She's happy. And for the followers of the show, yesterday was the 33rd anniversary of the kidnapping of Kent Vella, November 18th, 1987.
Really?
So yesterday was the anniversary.
Nah.
Yeah.
How many years? 87?
So 33. Yeah, I called him Tuesday night. Message.
You called the guy years ago. You called the guy you kidnapped the anniversary of the kidnapping.
Every year. He's unemployed now, so he wants to hear from me.
Talk about full circle, man.
Dog, I apologized to him. I did a bad thing. I apologized to him. He accepted it, and we became friends again.
That's great.
So I, I called him Tuesday night, left him a message. I was thinking about him. I go, 33 years ago tonight, I was planning on what to do with you. So.
I can't even.
Whether we were going to feed you to the lions or fucking put you in the trunk of a car. We didn't know yet.
All right, let me say this for those of you listening, because a lot of people have missed that. The last episode of that I actually was honored to host. Guest host the church, and that's the episode where we cover the kidnapping. So there's a lot of you like, hey, there seems to be a chapter missing. That's where you find that chapter. Okay, go to the church of what's happening now. Check out the episode I guest hosted, and that's where Joey tells that whole story. This time, exactly where we left off was February of 1989. You were just leaving prison. And what you said is it was the first time in the halfway house, which made me laugh because that means it's not the only time you're in the fucking halfway house.
When I think of my stint at BCTC.
And what does that stand for, it, Joey? BCTC. Was that
BCTC?
Boulder?
Boulder Community Treatment Center.
Okay.
Boulder County. The same people who owned BCTC owned LCTC, which was in Longmont, Colorado, about 20 minutes away.
Okay.
You didn't want to go, you know, they put you to where you were from, but they threatened to put me in Longmont at first. And I didn't mind because there was a little Mexican place out there called Delicioso. And they made the best fucking breakfast burritos you've ever had in your life. I'd put away like 8 of them.
Damn.
8, 9 of them. They were that good. Like, so I didn't care about going to Longmont, but I really wanted to go to Boulder, you know? So I found out, I went in, you got a 3-day orientation. You can't leave. You could call your loved ones and they could bring stuff in. The clothing you need, you know, whatever you need for your job. And then after 3 days, they let you go out just to find a job.
Okay, so let me ask you some questions, because we had this halfway house right next to my middle school, and one of my high school wrestling coaches worked there later in the years. He'd take us home in the van. He dropped, but we couldn't get in. You know, you can't get out. He has to get out of the van and let you out. We're like, oh, yeah, this is a correctional van. You can't get out of this motherfucker. But so you're now out of prison, but you're at this place where how many people would you say are also living under this roof?
About 90.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's way bigger than I thought it was. Okay, so you got 90 men?
You had three. No, the bottom floor was women. And then the two top floors were men.
Okay.
And it was 7 man rooms. And then when you moved up the system, you got put into a 3-man room.
So you're allowed out.
So my first experience.
Go ahead.
After 3 days, you're allowed out for about a week to find a job from like 9 to 5. You have to call them and let them know where you're going. So I got to call them and go, I'm going to Ryan Sickler's to interview at Goodyear. And then from there, you have to have a list for them. So I would just make up a phony fucking list of where I was going. And then those 3 days were kind of shaky. But then once you got, I got a job right away.
Doing what?
And then I think the first job I got was like a detailer at a car lot. But those first 3 days when, you know, they hold you for 3. And then that first day when they let you out to go get a job, I went and picked up an ounce of blow. I got to get back on the board here. You know what I'm saying? I'm down by 10. Something's got to be done here. I'm
down,
you know, forget getting a job at $8. At $8 an hour. I'm not getting no job for $8 an hour. So I started slinging. I got an ounce of coke right off the fucking bat. The fourth day out. The fourth day out. That's why all that shit you talk in prison is bullshit. I'm going to go out. I'm going to read the Bible. The fourth day out, the first place I went to was my buddy's to get an ounce on Eon, to go to work.
Let me ask you, what did it feel like, though, to be just out? You know, you're now, I'm including the half, you're on your own. I know you have a curfew, but what does it feel like, that first feeling of after all the shit you've been through, you're actually breathing the outdoors right now? There's not someone watching you when you're walking or driving or taking the bus to your friend's house.
I knew that at that moment I was never going back into the prison. I did know that. I did know that I was a criminal. I came to that conclusion. And I figured out that whatever I did from now on, I had to have a cover to it, and I had to keep it low, you know. It would be small moves. Selling coke was the alternative. I mean, I could sell coke all day long. So just to get on the board, I started slinging coke, like the third, the fourth day, just to put some money in my pocket, generate some income, you know, move around. And then I got like a job. I really don't know, Ryan. I would be lying to you if I told you what my first job was. I can't remember. But I got a job right away. And I still remember bringing the coke into the halfway house with me.
I was going to ask you. Okay.
Like that takes, okay? And I still remember weighing it in the bedroom on the top bunk. And I still remember one day that, like in my first 2 weeks, the chick that ran the place did a surprise attack on me while I was weighing the coke.
Oh, shit.
And I had it in like a big, I had it in a big bindle. When I put it in, the coke flew all out of the bindle. But it was in little chunks. So she walks into the room. I got the scale hidden like fucking, Richard Gere, an Officer and a Gentleman. I had it up in the ceiling. I had everything hidden in the ceiling, but she comes in and there's still all these little coke rocks on the carpet. And she goes, "You guys need to do some carpeting and we got to get the maintenance guy to come in here and vacuum the dust off this stuff." She thought it was fucking dust from the ceiling.
Oh,
she didn't know that there was an ounce of coke, you know, on the fucking floor in little chunks. You know, that this is what I walked into. I mean, you create this life for yourself. So that was it off the bat. Then I got a job, but I kept slinging coke. And then eventually I started snorting coke. And I walked into BCTC maybe in February. And by April, I already gave my first hot UA. So the first one is free. The first one is you get locked up for 14 days. You're only allowed to go to work. No leisure, no gym, no nothing. So I figured out a different idea. Instead of getting a job, I went to my buddy's garage. He had a garage where he fixed cars, and I would hustle details there. But I got a pager. So they didn't know where I was. They could also drop into your job. I made it that I was driving cars back and forth. So don't come in here because I'm never going to be there. It was just a different level.
Yeah.
They weren't even ready for me. Like, they weren't even ready for the game I was imposing on them. They could shake you down at any time and you couldn't have more than $40 on you.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. You had to pay. It was, at that time, it was $75 a week rent. And you also got a box of food, like frozen Swanson dinners, you know, cheese slices, shitty food, you know, for the week. I used to get food delivered. I'd get Chinese food delivered, and they'd lose their fucking mind. Like, I showed up just completely different. Like, I was running my own game in there. Then I gave them the hot urinalysis. And then they were really on me.
And that was just coke?
Once you give them a hot UA, just coke. I wasn't smoking dope or anything. Once I gave him the first hot, I came to the conclusion that I can't snort coke, and I was fine with that. But I still needed to sell coke to make some money. The job was just to cover. The other thing I devised was you had to pay rent on Thursday, but everybody got paid on Friday. So if you didn't pay rent on Thursday, you wouldn't get your leisure time on the weekend. That opened up another avenue for me, loan sharking. So I would lend out $75 for 102. So I give you 75 on Thursday, you give me 102 on Friday. I was a one-man fucking wrecking crew.
You got $27 profit on that shit.
That's yeah, great. And I had 10 of those motherfuckers every week. So I became a loan shark. I was slinging coke, and I was hustling whatever job I was doing.
Now, wait, are you also then, selling coke to people in the halfway house, or are you just hiding it there?
I'm hiding it there, but I'm also selling it to people at the halfway house.
So they're all after doing the it. So any of them could to give a hot test then, all coming from the coke.
Oh, yeah. Oh. They were all. I had a couple guys I was selling it to. Once I got the first hot UA, I had a garage I rented about 8 blocks away on 16th Street. I paid $35 a month, and I had a heavy bag in there and a bar way before I got arrested. I kept that little gym, so I started stashing my coke in there. It was only a walk away, so I would stash it in there, have the scale in there. So I'm loan sharking in there. I'm slinging coke. I'm fucking around, and then guess what happens? I give him another hot UA. Even though I wasn't doing coke, just touching it.
Ah, okay. I wondered, yeah. Handling it?
Just wait. Because the guy would give me like 6 ounces at a time, and it would be like 4 chunks and a half ounce of powder. This motherfucking Mexican was a nut. So I would have to pick up these chunks of coke. It was like fucking... His coke was real. It was fucking tremendous. So from weighing it, it went through my skin. And then I gave him up. I gave him another fucking hot UA. So now they were going to put me back in prison. So they hired my attorney to go in there and fight for me. You know, they had me on lockdown. I couldn't leave the building. And then they came to a conclusion that I go to a rehab. And I just mentioned the name of this rehab the other day. I forget the name of it. It was from 6 to 9 at night, 5 nights a week. And you had to sit there. And guess what? I went to this rehab for, I think it was 6 weeks, 3 hours a night, 5 nights a week. And I started selling more coke at the rehab than I ever did. Like, it was fucking crazy. It's so fucking.
That just made me.
It's dizzy. So embarrassing, you know. That'd be like 12 people in the group, and you know, like 9 of them were still getting high. Mm-hmm. So we're still getting high in there, but then something happened. I got a fucking call one day that I knocked up my girlfriend.
Okay. And this is what year are we at now? Right, 90? So are we in 90? Is still 89?
We're in 89.
Okay.
We're in like May of 89. I'm already in a fucking rehab. And now this poor girl tells me she's pregnant. Had to be about June. So now I had to fucking strap the belt on a little bit harder. And I stayed clean. And I went and sold the hot car at the time was the Eclipse by Mitsubishi.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine said that he needed help at his place selling Mitsubishis. So I went over there and I started making $8,000-$9,000 a month selling Mitsubishis. I would just sell Eclipses. I wouldn't even look at the fucking, because the Eclipse is hard to get and you made like $800 a car. Because you sold them above sticker price. So now I'm fucking selling cars, selling coke, loan sharking. I'm a one-man wrecking crew. I'm getting watches sent out from New Jersey, Rolex watches, presidentials. The guy would give them to me for like $7,000. I would sell them for 10. It was the prime of a joke. I was doing more hustling in those months than I ever did before. Like, it was the top of my hustle game. I was 27 years old, 28, and I was making probably $15,000 a month.
Damn.
Between the selling cars, the selling coke. I wasn't snorting, so it was all profit, you know.
This is $15,000 a month in 89.
Oh, yeah. I'm fucking slinging with both hands.
Yeah.
And then they moved me into, I started making progress in the system. I started becoming a model prisoner.
A model prisoner.
Oh, my God. I turned it around. I fucking really turned it around. It was just amazing. They were blown away. No more hot UAs. I was doing everything I was supposed to do. I was on my best behavior. I had the best summer of my life. You there?
I'm here, brother.
Oh, I thought you froze up for a second. I had the best summer of my life selling cars. I didn't do coke the whole summer, but I was just a fucking renegade in there. And then I got them to, so high that they gave me a furlough, like a 4-day furlough to get married and to go on a honeymoon. But I had them at that time, and I did my program, and they let me out. They said, you're done here.
Really?
We're going to put you on regular community corrections. Yeah, so once you get married and come back, get your stuff and get out. And then you just gonna, you still got to go to meetings and circle jerks and all that shit. So by August of 89, I was a free fucking man.
Because you're married.
Because I'm married. I get married. I move into my place.
Wait, sorry. What month do you get married?
September of 89.
But you officially are, because you're getting married, you actually get out before the wedding?
I get out. They said like a week before I got married, they go, you know, by the way, your time is done. Your time is done. You could do your last 6 months from the house.
So that's what I wanted to ask.
So I had like 6 months left.
But you could do it from the comfort of your own home as long as you're married because you have a family.
No. I had nothing to do with being married.
Oh.
I was just, my time was done.
Okay, gotcha.
I had done my time in there. I had been in there from February. It was now September. And it was 7 months. And they were like, you came in here with like a 16-month sentence left. Something weird. So the last 8 months you could do on house probation.
Hell yeah.
So I was still on community corrections. I still had a pee in a bottle. I still had to do all that stuff. I get married. I'm clean. Everything's fine. But my buddies come out for the wedding. And they give me a package at the wedding. So I do a couple bumps at the wedding, and you're not stopping me.
Oh, I know what.
Yeah. I got on the plane. I'm fucked up. You know, I'm drinking on the plane. I get to San Francisco. She falls asleep, and I go out to see a friend of mine because I lived in San Francisco in 85. So I went looking for a friend of mine. He gave me an 8-ball. I stayed up all night in the garage doing it with a fucking 8-pack of beer, a 6-pack of beer. I walked upstairs at 7. I got in bed, and she woke up, and we went on a honeymoon. Like, you know, we went to an Oakland A's game with Canseco and all those guys.
Bash Brothers.
And then Monday, Monday night, we went to Monday Night Football, opening game, the Giants at the Niners.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
But I came back on Tuesday and I had the bug in me, dog. I was back on the powder. So I started doing powder. I worked against the clock. I would snort on Friday nights because I could possibly be clean by Monday. You know,
were your tests random at this point, or did you know when they were coming? At this
they
point?
Test, they tested me Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays.
Damn.
So you had to call a number at 1 o'clock, and the number would tell you what color was up. And there was some Mondays where they wouldn't test me, so I played against the clock. I would get high on Fridays because if you didn't test me on Monday, chances were you were going to test me on Wednesday. But if they tested you on a Friday, that means you were going to get tested again on Monday.
Okay.
So you always had to play the clock.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did it great. Then they started nailing me on Mondays, and that's when I went to work. I would like, if I called at 1 and my color was up, I would go to Albertsons and buy a bottle of vinegar. A white vinegar, distilled vinegar, 32 ounces, and a bottle of Gatorade, and I would get a package of Certo. Certo is what you use to make like a Jell-O.
Okay, yeah.
And I would drink the whole bottle of white vinegar.
No, dude.
With Gatorade.
You would mix 32. That's fucking 4 cups of vinegar and Gatorade mixed? What does that taste like? That's
I would drink.
Shit.
You know, when you're a fucking junkie, this is what happens when you're a junkie.
Doesn't that burn your throat?
So
and shit?
I got. Oh, it just destroys your insides. I got away with it like maybe twice.
So wait, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but this is supposedly a concoction that's going to neutralize this test or give you a negative test?
This is the word on the street.
Got it.
That you had to drink vinegar, but at the end of the day, nothing works. They always get you. It's some type of metabolites or something. So I got away with the test like maybe 2 times, and then maybe like mid-October, they fucking nailed me. They nailed me again. And instead of rehab, they said, you're going back into the halfway house. You're going to do an extra fucking group meeting. And like, you know, I went from being the model guy to the fucking schlub. So I would wake up every morning and walk to my apartment. I lived about 2 miles from the halfway house. I would walk to the apartment, see my wife, get changed, and go to fucking work. And that really made me become a little better. Like I did, you know, just the realization of what I had done and stuff. I'm like, God damn it. I can't get my fucking life together. And I started working I still sold coke, you know. I wasn't doing it. I said, let me just do this steady, you know. And I stuck to the program. I went to the fucking AA meetings, you know. I did everything I had to do. The holidays came. I was great. And then I got myself up to level 4, which was unheard of. That was unheard of. Like, a lot of people didn't make it to that top tier. That top tier let you stay out till midnight, and it gave you 2 furloughs a month. So you'd go home on Friday and come back on Sunday night.
Okay, twice a month.
I was that good. And I got my driving privileges.
Oh wait, you weren't allowed to drive before that?
No, but I was driving. I didn't give a French a fuck. I remember being at a light one day. I remember being at a light one day, and one of the counselors pulled up next to me at the light. And I'm like, fuck. But it was funny. Those months when I was a junkie, I tormented their fucking world, Ryan, because I couldn't figure out how to beat the drug test. So I started fucking getting like chlorine for a pool.
Mm-hmm.
And I would grind it down into a powder. And I would pull the skin back on my dick and sprinkle the chlorine on my helmet.
Jesus Christ.
And then pull the skin back and then put like a fucking rubber band on my dick.
Wow.
And I would pull this. So I started fucking around with that test. They couldn't figure out what the fuck was going on.
You're
right?
Putting chlorine so then, in the test? Oh, man. But doesn't that burn the fuck out of your dick?
Fuck,
your dick skin's so sensitive.
Fucking pool cleaner. Pool cleaner.
Yeah, I know. Tablets, I was a lifeguard. I know what you're talking about. I feel like that would burn your dick skin.
I was grinding them down. It was tremendous. It was really tremendous. I was grinding it down into a fucking powder and putting it on my dick. And I was fucking with them. And then one week I used Drano.
Come on.
It was tremendous. It was tremendous. I was driving these two. It was a team. It was a man and woman team that would test you. And then they also, when you're level four, they also have the right to come to your house whenever they want, knock on the door and check your house, your refrigerator, smell around to see if there's weed. They knocked on my door 10 times. You know how many times I opened that door? Zero. I don't open a door for strangers. Zero. Listen to me. I would turn the TV off. They would come back with a sheriff's car and sit outside my door for 2-3 hours. I would outweigh the sheriffs. I'm not going anywhere. Zero. My attorney would call me. He's like, you got to open the door for them. No, I don't. They don't have a warrant. Well, they have this from the court. Fuck that shit. I got to see a warrant. I know my rights. I'm like Jay-Z. I know my rights. You got to show me the fucking warrant.
Let's take a quick break and tell you about our first sponsor, Honey. Now, imagine this. You make a list of the gifts you're going to buy for the holidays, right? And then someone randomly gives you the money to help buy one. Sound good? Well, that's what Honey is doing. They're helping pay for $1 million worth of gifts. All right. You're probably wondering, is this the same Honey that automatically searches for promo codes online? Yes. Yes, it is. With Honey, you can also make a list of the holiday gifts you want from certain stores, and Honey will email you when the price drops on anything on your list. You just add Honey to your computer, you create a free account, and you throw some holiday gifts on your drop list for a chance to win. Honey will randomly select winners and give them the money to help buy something on their list. All right, I'm looking for some stuff for my daughter right now. I got her this Bill Nye virtual reality thing where you can do all these science experiments, virtual reality, since you can't go to school now. You can still feel like you're really doing this stuff there. Any gifts you want, you put them on the list, and Honey will give you a heads up, all right? There's no purchase necessary. You need a PayPal account to redeem the prize. Only valid in the U.S., and the giveaway ends 12/21/2020. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/honeydew. Once again, Honey is free, and you can get it at joinhoney.com/honeydew. Our next sponsor is ExpressVPN. Now, when you use the bathroom, you always close the door behind you, right? I hope you do. You don't want random passerbys looking in on you, so why would you let people look in on you when you go online? Using the internet without ExpressVPN is like going to the bathroom and not closing the door. Did you know that your internet service provider like Comcast or Verizon, they know every single website you visit? And what's worse is they can sell this information to ad companies and tech giants who will use your data to target you. ExpressVPN puts a stop to this. It creates a secure, encrypted 10-tunnel between your device and the internet so that your online activity can't be seen by anyone. I use ExpressVPN on all my devices. It works on everything. phones, laptops, even routers. So everyone who shares your Wi-Fi can still be protected even if they don't have ExpressVPN. And the best part is that using ExpressVPN is as easy as closing the bathroom door. You just fire up the app, you click one button, boom, you're protected. ExpressVPN is the world's number one rated VPN by CNET, Wired, The Verge, and countless others. So if you're like me and you believe your online activity is your business, secure yourself by visiting expressvpn.com/honeydew today. Use my exclusive link, expressvpn.com/honeydew, and you can get an extra 3 months for free. That's a lot, 3 months. That's expressvpn.com/honeydew. Now, let's get back to the dude.
That motherfucker was banging on that door. And then something weird happened. I went to my coke dealer's house, who was a dear friend also. And he asked me if I had ever seen this comedian. And I go, what are you fucking talking about? And he goes, this comedian, Andrew Dice Clay. And I go, no. And I saw that. That had to be November of 89. Mm-hmm. And I saw that special and my head blew up.
Yeah.
Like I kept watching it and watching it and watching it. And then for New Year's Eve, I was in the halfway house. So I talked them into renting the conference room and having a party for New Year's Eve, non-alcoholic, showing the Andrew Dice Clay special on VHS. And I got like fucking pizza brought in from Abo's. And they let me do it. And I watched Andrew Dice Clay. And 1990, they let me out of the halfway house February 2nd of 1990 on a Friday. My then wife picked me up, pregnant as can be, ready to bust. She picked me up. We went to a restaurant called Lucille's. It's still in Boulder. Fucking tremendous. It's Cajun.
Oh, I love Cajun.
I got the three eggs with the redfish and the bayonets with these fucking potatoes. It was February 2nd. It had to be 60 degrees out, brother. We got back to the apartment about 4 o'clock. I think I watched the news, and I must have passed out about 7. And I woke up February, they just let me out of the halfway house. I wake up February 3rd to a woman yelling. Okay. And it was my ex-wife that her water had broken.
Okay.
And she's like, you know, we got to get out of here. No, I'm about to have this baby. I fucking jump in the shower. I'm getting ready. I go outside and a foot and a half of snow fall. I had been sleeping. I didn't even see the snow.
Yeah.
So I go, hold on 1 second. I got to unshovel the fucking car. So I get the car. I shovel it. I shovel the spot as best as I could. I have the car running. I back up the fucking car and I pull it out just to get her to come in. And the fucking guy who lived upstairs came with his car and pulled into my spot. After I had just shoveled it. I just got out of the halfway house. Yeah. I go, this isn't happening. So I go up to the guy. I go, Doug, what are you doing? My wife is pregnant inside. I got to pull her out. And he said some snide remark. And I go, you're not fucking getting off this easy. Move your fucking car. And he goes, I'm not moving my car. And he spit on my car.
Whoa.
So I just fucking, I punched him right in the fucking face. And here, my wife is inside, and I'm fist fighting some dude.
In the driveway.
Between you and me, Ryan Sickler, this guy had me. He clocked me like 3 times straight, and he kind of had me. But he slipped on the ice. And I jumped on him and started beating the fuck out of him. I'm pounding him in the head. And next thing you know, I look up, and there's 3 cop cars coming at me. I'm like, I'm never gonna make it out of this fucking system. Like I'm a dead man. So the cops pull up next to me. You know, I run up to the cops. I know one of them. and I'm telling the cop what happened. They go, we got a report of a woman yelling. Like, we got a report of a fucking, like, a woman getting domestic violence. Well, what the fuck is going on here? And I go, there's no, my wife is inside yelling because her water broke. I'm out here. I've shoveled the fucking thing. Look where my car is. And this guy just sneaks his way in. So I'm like, I'm dead. I'm going to go to prison for the rest of my life. They have a talk, and the cops decide, they go, listen, it was just a misunderstanding. Why don't you guys just apologize to each other, your neighbors? You're going to have to fucking live with each other. I'll never forget the cop going, pull your hands out and shake hands. The guy goes, I'm not shaking his hand. And the cop looks at him, he goes, you know what? We could just get back in the car. You weren't doing too good when we got here. So you better shake his fucking hand. Look at your face. The cop, the dude was all banged up, and he wouldn't shake my hand. And the cop told him, you weren't doing too good when we got here. You know what I'm saying? So you better shake his fucking hand. So the cops actually give me they gave me an escort to the hospital.
That's nice.
So I got my wife in the car, drove it to the hospital, had the baby. She's in the hospital. I go home. I get an 8-ball to celebrate. You know me, dog. Yeah. Old habits never change. Now, even though I'm free, I still owe them like 8 more months of piss test. And that's when my world began. I just started fucking blowing up their machines. Every time I go in there for a piss test, I would throw something else on my dick to fuck their machine up. Bromo seltzer, Alka-Seltzer, fucking pool cleaner. I put Alka-Seltzer.
You must have like a leather dick, I tell you, man. I don't think I can handle any of that shit. Oh, that's so good.
Fucking Alka-Seltzer. That's how deep my whatever ran. I had a little girl. You know, man, this is why I tell people, nothing's going to change you unless you change yourself.
Amen.
I've sat with men thousands of times, you know, doing fucking an ounce of coke, telling me, I love my kids. This is the last time I'm going to get high. You'll never see me again after tonight, you know. Kids can't stop you from getting high. Probation can't stop you from getting high. Nothing can stop you from getting high. When you're going to get high, you're going to get high. People don't realize that. I know the other side of it. I think back to my times, that time period of my life. It didn't matter. And you know what made it worse, Ryan? That they gave me a rule I couldn't get high. I don't do well by rules. Right. You know, we're comedians. That's why we became comedians, because we cannot follow society's rules.
No.
I wake up every morning at 5 in the morning, 6, 7, 8. I'm an early riser. I'm on social media at 7:30 in the morning. You know, if I had a job, I wouldn't wake up at 8 in the morning. When I have to do something, I'm not going to do it. There's no way. You know, I've been on my own basically since I was 10. My mother gave me, when I got out of Catholic school, my mother made me an offer I couldn't refuse. I'm going to let you do it your way. The first time you fuck up, you go back to my way. So looking back at it now, I couldn't handle rules. When they dropped that whole program, I stopped getting high as much. I noticed that because I had a fucking rule. And I can't follow rules. I do what I do. Why I do it, I don't know. And I'm going to keep doing it. That's just the way I am, you know. That's my malfunction, that I can't obey rules. I couldn't live under society standards. That's my malfunction. But at that time, I was already thinking about stand-up. I just didn't know how to start.
And how old are you now?
I just had no idea.
1990. How old are you now?
I'm 27 years old.
Okay. So this is just starting to think about stand-up at 27.
Just starting to think about it, still working, you know. At this time, I probably had three jobs. I was working at a car dealership. I was, you know, selling cars from the paper. Like, if you had a car for sale for $5,000, I would offer you $42,000, fix the car up a little bit, and sell it for $6,000. You know, I was fucking hustling my ass off at this point. At the age of 30, I was a fucking... And then my family asked me if I want to go work for them. They were moving their roofing operation from New Jersey to Colorado. And they were looking for laborers. So I said, yeah, I might as well go work for family. You know, I didn't want to sell cars anymore. And I caught on really quick to roofing. It was flat roofing. It was rubber roofing. It's called ballasted roofing. It's flat roofs with rocks on it. You put rubber down, insulation, and then you ballast it with rocks and you frame the stuff with the metal, whatever you call it. I don't know. So I got into that, and my whole thing was to get on stage. I was such a fucking pussy, Ryan. I mean, you know, because I knew that I roofed. I had sold stuff. I had worked in restaurants as a bartender. I did fucking everything, and there was nothing I really liked, you know. And when I got into the roofing, and then I got promoted to an estimator. So I took like a Goodyear seminar. I had to take a Carlisle seminar. Anybody who makes rubber, they would invite me to their seminars. My company would pay for me to go to their seminars. And then I actually took a class on how to estimate, you know, constructions cost and all that stuff. So I became an estimator. And I really enjoyed it. But something was missing. I bought a condo. I had a truck. I had a car. I was married. I had been in prison. I had defied the odds. I got out of that fucking program. You know how I got out of that program?
How?
I was working at a car wash as a host. And right before I got into roofing, I used to talk to a guy once a week. He would come in and just talk to me. How you doing? What's going on? I would talk to him. And one day after like 6 months, I go, what do you do? And he goes, I'm the district attorney. And I go, you're Bill Wise? And he goes, yeah. The real district attorney was Alex Hunter, but underneath him was Bill Wise. The reason why I mention these names to you are they were involved in the JonBenet Ramsey stuff.
Oh, okay.
Years later.
Okay.
What's his name was the mayor, and Bill Wise was the DA, and he was forced to resign over the JonBenet thing. But I got to tell you, he was a good man. I talked to him every day for a long, you know, I talked to him once a week. We would have conversations while I was out there. And when I told him what I had done, I go, I got in trouble with the whole Vela thing. And he goes, that was you? And we started talking and giggling. And he goes, just have your attorney put the motion on my desk. I'll sign it behind the other DA's back. The DA that prosecuted me, he said, fuck him. He goes, fuck him. I'll sign it. And he signed it. And I was let off. I think November of 90.
Okay.
I was done with my sentence. Everything was done.
Everything. Now you're done.
I could snort.
You could snort. Yeah, you could snort all the coke you want. Huh?
Do whatever the fuck I want. But something wasn't right. Something wasn't right in me. Something just didn't feel right. I was making money. I had everything that America society tells you you need to move forward. I had everything in the palm of my hand. But something wasn't right, Ryan Sickler. So this is it. This is fucking it. I work 5 days a week. On Saturday, I watch the kid because you got to work. And then on Sunday, we go to your parents' house to eat. And I start all over on Monday. And then one day when I'm 65, you give me a gold watch. And you tell me my years of service were great. That was it. Something wasn't right. Just something didn't seem right. So I searched. My answer was religion. So I started going back to church. I got confirmed. Remember when I got thrown out of Catholic school right before my confirmation?
Yeah.
So I said, what I need is the Holy Spirit to be complete. So I went, I got confirmed. I took classes at night. I made my confirmations. I was still fucking miserable. So I went to Naropa Institute. My friend was at a restaurant at Naropa Institute. It's a college in Boulder for Buddhists. It's accredited. You know, you go there and get a degree in philosophy, you're going to end up a fucking waiter with dirty feet. But, you know, it's, I took a couple classes and I really enjoyed Buddhism. I liked it. I liked the principles. I took a Monday night class on walking meditation, you know, the whole thing. I was looking for something. Something was fucking missing. Something wasn't right, you know. And that March of 91, it snowed. And I went to one of the job sites we were working at. And the guys were like, bro, our fucking labor didn't show up today. And we have nobody to go get us food. Can you go get us food? And I was like, fuck yeah. You know, there was a diner around the corner and they had green chili. I was hungry anyway. I'll go, let me go over there and get the green chili. And when I was, they had like boots and then they had like a, you know, like a bar, like a, it was an old school diner.
Yeah.
And when I sat at the bar, there was a Denver Post, a Rocky Mountain News, the newspaper. You know how sometimes you just take a newspaper and open it?
Yeah. Well, I remember doing that back in the day. Yeah.
Like just opening it, not the first page.
Yep. Just fold
it. But like
open.
The middle, right? To go right to the sports kind of thing. I did that. I opened up the paper and in the paper, the front page I opened was an ad. Roseanne had just blown up. So the Denver comedy scene was blowing up. And there was an ad about the Denver. It wasn't an ad. It was a write-up about the Denver comedy scene and what had happened since Roseanne blew up. How many more comedians were going to, how come the club became more popular, the Denver Comedy Works. And then at the bottom, it said, are you thinking of becoming a comedian? And it told you the options to do. And they had an ad for a stand-up comedy class at the University of Colorado in Boulder. It was right up the corner from my house. It was three Sundays. It was $38, and it was taught by a guy named Jeff Harms. I'll never forget that guy. He was a stand-up comic, and he was part of an improv troupe. Uh-oh, somebody got stabbed in Los Angeles. He was part of an improv.
You hear that?
If it's not a fire department, it's a fucking helicopter. So he got, he was part of an improv troupe. It was three Sundays from 1 to 4. He just broke down stand-up comedy and blah, blah, blah. And then the last week you had to go up in front of everybody. And the last week I went up, I don't know if I got any laughs or not. It didn't matter. I just wanted to go up, you know. And when I got off before class ended, as I was walking out, he came over to me. He goes, what's your name? And I go, Joey. And he goes, I usually don't tell this to the students, but you have a career in stand-up if you want to. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he goes, you could do this. I could see it. You could do this. And I was like, I'm a roofer, you know, I'm married. I'm dead.
Yeah.
I just took the course just to see, you know. And he goes, if I was you, I'd look into it. And he goes, here's my phone number. Stay in touch. And about 2 days later, he called me. And he said that a new club was opening up. And they were looking for doormen. he'd get me a job as a doorman. That club's name was Wits End Comedy Club in Westminster, Colorado. It's no longer there. It was like a C room, mm-hmm. you know? And I started a job as a doorman there. And I remember that, like that April, you know, in Colorado, even though it's not winter, sometimes you get snow.
Yeah.
Like it'll just snow a foot and a half in April. And I'll never forget that that April it snowed and I didn't have to work that day. So I went and rented the movie with Tom Hanks about stand-up comedy.
Yeah, Sally Field and Tom Hanks. And
yeah, Sally Field. I watched that and I just went over the fucking top. Like, I'm like, I got to do this shit. I wasn't happy at all. Something, I had everything I wanted that you're supposed to have as an American that's 28 years old. I was a felon, but I wasn't letting that stop me. That wasn't going to get in my way, you know. And I worked the door for a few months. I asked comics questions. You know, nobody was around today. I just asked stupid questions, and I kept asking questions and asking questions. And I kept calling the Comedy Works to get on their open mic. And every 2 weeks, they would call me back and go, Mr. Diaz, you got a 3-minute spot on Tuesday. And then on Tuesday, I would call and cancel.
Why? You scared?
Every time they get petrified.
Yeah.
I went through a couple months of that shit. I'm just canceling and, you know, canceling. I'm going to write my fucking story. I would never write, you know. I got to get it down. And then one Tuesday or 1 week in July, my ex-wife heard me call up the Comedy Works. Or she heard them call me and say, you have a spot next Tuesday. So without telling me, she got a babysitter. Mm. So she forced my hand. So it was July 16th, 1991. It took me 16 months to get the courage to go on fucking stage. And I remember just driving down to Comedy Works. I have no idea what I said, but I remember going up on stage. And at that time, I had done everything. You know, I had done heroin. I had done coke. I had, you know. When I walked off stage, I can't describe the high I had.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't stoned. I wasn't on coke. I wasn't, that whole day, I didn't do anything. This was my moment to see if I could do this or not. Like, for me, July 16, 1991 was my turning point. When I got off stage, the owner of the Comedy Works at the time, it was Wendy.
Yeah.
But it was also a guy named Ed Nichols came up to me. Ed Nichols came up to me and he goes, you got a really good stage presence. You should really stick this out. And a guy, PJ Moore, came up to me and said, what are you doing tomorrow night? I got a gig. Can you do 5 minutes? And I was like, yeah, I can do 5 minutes. And I got the fucking gig.
Let's take a quick break and tell you about our next sponsor, Helix. Now, I've been on the road a lot. I've slept in a lot of places. I've bounced around my whole life. And I'm telling you, there's nothing more important than a comfortable mattress. I had a friend of mine whose grandma said to me one time, spend good money on a bed because it's where you rest your soul. And I'm telling you, that's never been more true than now. All right. I got the Helix mattress. I got the Midnight Lux. This is the best mattress I've ever had, man. I have it in my daughter's room. We go in there, got the queen size. I read to her. We both fall asleep, but I'm not even supposed to fall asleep. I have work to do, and I'm in there passing out because it's so comfortable. Helix Sleep has a quiz, okay? You can take this quiz. It takes 2 minutes to complete, and it matches your body type and sleep preferences to the perfect mattress for you. Everybody's unique, and Helix knows that. So they have several different mattress models to choose from. They have soft, medium, and firm mattresses. Mattresses are great for cooling you down if you sleep hot, and even a Helix Plus mattress for plus size folks. I took the Helix quiz. I was matched what I already said, the Midnight Lux mattress, because I wanted something that felt like a medium firm and I sleep on my side. Okay. I love it. Like I said, it's a huge upgrade over what I used to have. And I'm telling you, and here's the good thing is you don't have to spend a ton of money to rest your soul. Helix has you covered. The delivery and setting up was fast and easy. It's soft, but it's still really supportive. I'm falling asleep right away. I'm sleeping well. My daughter loves it. Everybody's into it. So if you're looking for a mattress, you take the quiz, you order the mattress that you're matched to, and the mattress comes right to your door. It's shipped for free. You don't ever need to go to a mattress store again. Helix is awesome, but you don't need to take my word for it. Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 and by GQ and Wired Magazine. So just go to helixsleep.com/honeydew, take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. That's a no-brainer. All right, they'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it, but you will. Helix is offering up to $200 off of all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for my listeners at helixsleep.com/honeydew. That's helixsleep.com/honeydew. Our next spot is Upstart. You know we love Upstart. I love Upstart. You guys love Upstart. So many of you have hit me and used their service, and I absolutely am grateful for you, and I'm glad you're loving it, because there's a lot of economic chatter right now about the state of the market. Is it recovering? How long will it take? Have we seen the worst? But if you're struggling to pay off high-interest credit card debt, you can't wait for those answers. You need to take action now with Upstart. There's actually something you can do today to help fight off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart is the revolutionary online lending platform that knows you're more than just a credit score. Unlike other lenders, Upstart can reward you based on your job history in the form of a smarter rate. Upstart lets you skip going to the bank because it's completely online. They offer loans from $1,000 all the way up to $50,000, so you can consolidate your debt into one easy fixed rate payment. Upstart makes it fast and simple to check your rate. Since it's just a soft pull, it does not affect your credit score. The hard pull happens if you accept your rate and proceed with your application. And the best part is if the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 500,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards or meet their financial goals. Like I said, you guys are using it. I know you are. It really does help you. Don't pay that insane high interest. These credit card companies got bailed out years and years ago, and they're still hitting us with high interest. No. Use Upstart. Free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt and get back to using your money your way with Upstart. See why Upstart has over 6,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/honeydew to find out how low your Upstart rate can be. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. That's upstart.com/honeydew. Now, let's get back to the dew.
I'll never forget on the drive home, like, what was going through my mind. Like, this is it. This is what I want to do. But I'm dead. I can't do it. It's very hard to tell your wife that you want to get into stand-up comedy
and work for life free nothing. When you just had a baby.
When you just have a child. Yeah. It was dead. I was dead.
Yeah.
So whatever dreams I had were dead. They were really dead. It was like then I was really fucking broken in half. You know, I'm like, what am I going to do now? I'm stuck being a fucking roofer and estimator. Nothing wrong with it. It's a decent job. It's better than being in jail. But I really wanted to do the stand-up. And I just, it was like, and I got on stage like maybe 3 times that July, maybe 3 times that August. And then something just wasn't right still. That feeling came back. So my wife at the time told me, you have money saved up. Maybe you need to find yourself. Go home. I hadn't been in New York for 6 years at that point. I hadn't seen my friends in 6 years. So I came home for a week, snorted coke, was out of arena. I remember they gave me a police car at the Hertz rental.
What?
They gave me like an old.
Yeah.
They rented me a car, but it was a detective car. And I still remember going to the Bronx and people were like, nah, we ain't want to deal with you, dog. You're
yeah, right. That Crown Vic car?
Yeah, it was a Crown Vic. So I remember going back home and just feeling empty, like I'm never going to be able to do this fucking dream, you know? I get on stage here and there, but all these guys talk about the road. And you know, you hear Bob Seger talking about the road.
Yeah.
And Bon Jovi talking about the road. And you know, something just wasn't right. So I kept living my life. I kept estimating. I kept selling cars. And then there was this Nissan truck that opened up. Somebody told me they had a Nissan truck for sale. But I already had like two cars tied up. I already had like $8,000 tied up in two cars. And I had like $4,000 laying around upstairs. But I was still $3,000 light. So I ran a scam when I was at the University of Colorado with Pell Grants and fucking scholarships and shit. And I knew, you know, I got every fucking Latino scholarship that was ever made. Pancho Villa. Everybody sent me five. Everybody sent me 500 that went right to the Coke dealer. You know what I'm saying? So I said, how can I come up? Oh, it was like a fucking scam. So I went to the Boulder. I went to the University of Colorado. I went downstairs and they had like a loan office. And I went in there and I said, listen, I got some credits I owe you. I want to go back. And they go, well, it's too late to get a Pell Grant. It was right there in September, right there when you sign up for fall semester. So I said, let me just get a loan. And they said, fine. And they gave me a loan. I signed up for the classes. Once I got the loan, I bought the car. They gave me a loan for $26,25. Mm-hmm. The standard loan. I bought the car and I sold it the next day for a $2,000 profit. So I just went back and paid off the loan.
Okay.
They were like, what the fuck is this? You know, like, and I did it again and then I owed them and I never paid it back. And my wife now made me pay it back.
She did for real?
Yeah, I took another loan out.
How much?
So let's work on $26,25.
You paid it all back, though? That was a standard.
Yeah. Oh, I had no choice. They just fucking.
They'll never stop.
Once you put a certain amount of money in your bank, those motherfuckers come back at you. Yeah. They just take a judgment on. I didn't want a judgment, so I just paid it off. But so I took this loan, and I paid it off 3 days later, and I withdrew from the school. Okay, I paid my bills and I never thought nothing of it. This is the beginning of September.
Okay,
I never thought anything of it again. I'm struggling. I'm struggling as a human being, like with this comedy and, you know, being a dad and being a roofer. I'm struggling with all this. And one day I get home at 5 o'clock and my ex-wife is in the kitchen. And when I turn around, she goes, do you have a minute? It was October 15th of 1991. And she holds up the loan and she goes, what is this? She goes, I just got this in the mail today. It's a receipt. You took a loan out without letting me know. And I'm like, at that point in my life, I was doing 1,000 things that nobody knew. You know what I'm saying? I didn't know I had to ask permission for my business. I didn't know. So she's like, I feel like that's lying and I want to get separated. And it was like, just a rush came over me. Like somebody just did me the biggest favor of my fucking life. I thought about my daughter who at the time was 18 months old, you know. She told me she was in a movie with her mom just to see how she felt and that we'd revisit in a few months. And Ryan, I almost fainted.
Really?
I almost fainted because it was like somebody had done something for me that I wanted to do. I really wanted to give this comedy shit a try. Like, I was dead serious about it. And I'll never forget that she packed up and left that day.
Because of that loan?
And that night. Yeah, but it wasn't the loan.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was a long time coming.
Sure.
The loan was the straw that broke the camel's back.
God.
You know, I talked about it on my podcast this week that like 2 months or 3 months before we broke up, we were eating dinner one night. And she said to me, she goes, I don't understand if you understand what you did. She goes, you took a man, handcuffed him, and put him in the back of a fucking trunk. Do you know what type of person does that? And she was right. I mean, Ryan, let's, you know, I was out of control.
Yes.
I was totally out of control. You know, I didn't see it at that time. I was chucking and jiving, but I think it took her like 3 years for her to sink in what I had really done, you know, and who she had married, you know, and she had made a mistake, you know. I actually took a guy. I had no problems with that at all, you know. That was just another day in the life for Joey Diaz, you know.
Yeah.
But that's the truth.
Yeah,
that was
then,
just,
yes.
At that time in my life, I had been on an 8-year roll, and if you think putting somebody in the back of a trunk of a car was bad, you missed my Aspen day. You know, you missed all that other shit, you know. But I think that, you know, she thought about her kid. She looked at her kid and said, what type of man am I is going to raise my child? You know, I was a different person then. That's why it's like the different lives of Joey Diaz, you know. And she left. But it was so weird. That night, I went in the paper, and I saw that the broker was a bar in Boulder. They were four bars. They had restaurants. The broker was a restaurant. But in Boulder, it was more of a pickup bar. On Wednesday nights, they had like a professionals night, and people went there. But Tuesday nights, they actually did comedy night. It was a steak night. $15. You got a steak, a salad, and you got to see a fucking comedian. And they were running the Beck's Broker Joker. Beck's has a beer, you know, Beck's beer. You know, in the 90s, what a lot of people don't understand was there was no Netflix. There was nothing like that. The exposure you got was from doing contests. There were certain contests you did. Johnny Walker had a contest. There were more national contests. HBO had a contest. Everybody had contests. NBC had a contest. I remember going to an NBC contest, signing up and waiting. I had never been on stage before. And like two people before me, I just left. Like, I just fucking left. Because some guy in front of me had like a comedy club jacket on. I'm like, these guys are pros. I've never been on stage before. I'm just going to go up there and bomb. I still remember going into an audition for Charlie Hill. Charlie Hill was at the University of Boulder, and they were looking for local comics to come in. And I had to walk into a room with like three students in there and do my fucking stupid jokes. The three guys looked at me like, what are you, you're the worst comedian we've ever seen in a while. You know? But it was so weird. I went down to the broker, and I became part of this contest that started in like September, but they were having like prelim rounds.
Right.
October, November, with the finals being December 18th, 1991. The winner got $500. And I just invited my friends from Boulder. And I went to the contest, and I kept winning every week the rounds. I kept coming in first place, like, it was like every other week I had to go down there, and then I could hang out and watch the comics. You know, I was going to the Comedy Works at the time and doing 3 minutes down there. And I was doing the broker, and that was it. There was not a lot of comedy rooms at the time.
But that's where your comedy career was born, in Denver.
Yes, it started in Denver. And then December 18th, 1991. What I was doing was I was selling Valiums at the time. All right, just straight up. So all these Coke guys would tell me, hey, we want to buy Valiums. And I would go, oh, if you want volumes, you got to come to the broker. I'll be at the broker. They're like, what the fuck are you doing at the broker? I go, I'm doing comedy. And they're like, we didn't even know you did comedy. I'm like, yeah, you know, but how many volumes do you need? And they're like, 20. I go, all right, meet me at the broker. In those days, what I was doing was stocking the audience with my friends. They didn't know they were going to have to pay and sit. They would get there and go, we're here to see Joey. And the guy would go, you got to sit down and pay. So I would have like 20 people there. But they weren't there to see me. Right. They were there to buy drugs.
Yeah.
I would just tell them, that, meet me at the fucking broker to sell you drugs. So I was stocking every time I did a contact. Like, let's say you call me on Sunday and you wanted volumes for the week. I would hold you off till Tuesday and then make you
come to my show.
And then make you come, and then come to my show. So I would have 30 people in there. The night of the contest, there was maybe 118 people in there, and I had 90 people in there. I couldn't lose. I couldn't lose even if I wanted to, because they based it off of the applause.
Okay.
So I won the broker joker. I won the 500, but the house MC was a magician that was always drunk. He was the worst magician in the world. So I talked the owner of the general manager of the restaurant to let me host on Tuesday nights to get rid of the magician. I go,
get
look how many people
magician.
I bring. Get rid of the magician. This is a fucking comedy room. Yeah. He was an old magician.
Yeah.
You know, he hosted all of the events that they did. Like they did like movie night on Sunday nights.
He just came with
just
the place.
An old white.
Yeah, he came with the place.
Yeah, he was an old white guy. He was out of it. So I actually went up to this guy and asked him. I said, can I host here? Look at the amount of people I bring every week. Every time I perform, I got 90 coke fiends in here fucking drinking 18 cocktails. I was selling tickets even before I was known. So nobody fucking knew who I was. I was packing the place because I would tell them, come down. I'll have your drugs for you down there. So they made me the fucking house MC. January, the first week of January of 1992, I already had a job as a comic. I was getting $50 a show.
Yeah.
So that's $200 a month. And bitch, in my world, that's a fucking start.
Yeah.
$200 a month plus all you could eat, all you could drink. And that's how I started fucking comedy right there. That's how I got into it. A lot of people don't know that fucking story.
I didn't know that.
I won the broken joker.
I don't know why I felt like your early days were Seattle.
No, Seattle came in 95.
So after
this is still 90.
This is the very.
This is 91 going into 92.
Okay.
92 was fantastic. I was an open micer. I had my own night on Tuesday nights at the broker. I was single. I had every credit card imaginable. I had never used a credit card in my life. I didn't believe in them, but now I was single. I could do whatever the fuck I wanted to. And I was just doing comedy using credit cards. That's it.
January 1992.
Got a girlfriend, caused a lot of problems. And that's when the problem started with my ex. Because me and my ex were cool from November to like January. We were cool. Everything was great. And then she told me she moved in with a guy with my kid. So I'm like, you told me not to date nobody because we're Catholics. The divorce is finalized. And here you want to move the guy in with you.
In 3 months?
So I started getting, what the fuck? But this is all
I know.
Planned. This is all planned. So this is what happens when you're a loser. And you can't provide as a man, you know. I wasn't a family guy at all. I was, you know, I wanted to do comedy. But that's the transition into my comedy career. That's how I transitioned. It took me 16 months. I was fucking petrified. I didn't think I was good enough to do it. And I knew that if I failed, that was it. There was nothing else for me. Was I going to be a puppeteer? What was I going to do with my life? There was nothing else. I had already been a salesman. I worked in, I had done everything. This was it. When I got into comedy, I got into comedy knowing that this was it. There was no other options. I was too old for the Army. I was too, you know, I had been a, I was a felon. All my possibilities were cut in half. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I didn't know what I was really involved in. I was just getting on stage every week. I was reading the Judy Carter book. And in those days, there used to be a comedy newspaper that came out of San Francisco. And it just interviewed different comics and it told you about what was going on. And I just remember reading that every week. I would go and get it from, like, when I would go to the Comedy Works or something, I'd pick up a copy of it. You know, I had the, all those newspapers saved. And I would, in the back, I had a club thing of all the clubs in the country and the one-nighters. And I would fucking circle all those things and just cry and fucking say, one night I'm going to play the punchline in, in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Once I'm going to be up in Seattle, you know, at the Underground. I like their logo. Mm-hmm. It was kind of weird that I like Seattle Comedy Underground's logo. So I kept thinking to myself, I'm going to be in fucking Seattle someday, you know. But I had no idea what I was doing. I was just getting on stage at the Broker. And I kept doing that till I got fired. I got fired December of 93. By that time, I had lost everything. You know, I was just, you know, when you become a comic, you don't want a fucking day job. I was hustling. I was selling neon. I was selling some Valiums. I was dabbing some coke. But it was just basically to stay alive, you know, pay child support and do fucking comedy. But at that age, you know, I read the book by Lenny Bruce, Ladies and Gentlemen, Lenny Bruce, you know, and it was just about doing drugs and going out every night. And that's exactly what I did. That's what I wanted to do. It was about getting high, getting on stage. And in those days, there wasn't a lot of comedy in Denver. I was doing poetry readings.
What?
I was doing, you had to sneak in as a poet. So I would put on like a little hat with an apple on top. And I'd walk into a coffee shop and shit.
God damn. I wish there was a video of that shit somewhere.
Oh my God. The famous coffee shop was called Penny Lane in Boulder. It was Penny Lane. And I would go to Penny Lane. It was open 24 hours. Coffee shop, couches, you know, books, that type of stuff. A bunch of intellectuals, you know. And I would go in there for the 8 o'clock poetry reading, and they would throw me out every week. Stop, stop. You can't talk like that in here. I'd be talking about Godzilla and fucking killing Chinese people and shit on stage. And they were like, you can't do that. This is poetry night. But there was one manager who worked the midnight shift to 8 in the morning, and her boyfriend was in the halfway house with me. So she saw me there one night and she's like, you know, we do a poetry reading at midnight, from midnight to about 3 every morning. And I go, are you fucking serious? And she goes, come down. You're always welcome. So I would have to wait till midnight to do the poetry readings. And again, they would, you know, I'd have to follow a guy like that was up there. I ran, and I ran into the wilderness. And then I'd go up there throwing fucking heat, talking about Hitler and shit.
Oh, God. That's the kind of, I tell you, that's the one thing I do miss as a comic right now about live shows is sitting in the back and watching, you know, everybody else go up and do their thing. You know, I miss it. These motherfuckers, it's one of my favorite things, just sit back in the cut and watch people get up there and rip it up and just die laughing, try new shit, all of it, man. That's great. That's so funny. I ran.
You know, I was. Yeah, I was separated. I was heartbroken over my kid. I was kind of heartbroken over the divorce. But the fucking comedy just filled the gap. I couldn't explain it to people 20 some years later. Like, it made me get over everything. Mm-hmm. Like, just the fact that I was doing comedy, that I was part of it, you know. And like I said, the first year, I pretty much stayed out of the Comedy Works because the Boulder opened my, the Boulder show was the same nights as the Comedy Works open mic. So I was off the radar. There was one kid, there was a kid named Jimmy Abeda. And there was a guy named, I always give this guy props because John Payton, something Payton, Andy Payton. Andy Payton was his name. He really, Andy Payton was a comic with the mind of Gates. He's a mayor of a town now in Colorado. But Andy got sick and tired of not getting booked by clubs. There was three clubs in Denver at the time. And they wouldn't book, you know, a lot of crazy people then. So Andy would book his own 7 nights a week. He had a room. And he created a comedy newspaper. And he would sell ads to the to those rooms that he would do the comedy at. It was a brilliant concept. So I learned comedy from hustlers at the time. These guys, Jimmy Abeda and Andy Payton, were just fucking hustlers. They would walk into any bar and go, what do you do here on Tuesday nights? Nothing. What kind of budget do you have to work with? 150? Fuck it, we'll do a comedy show. A headliner gets 100. Everybody else gets to go on stage. And he takes home 50 bucks and everybody's happy. You know, so I came from that mentality. Mm-hmm. There was no comedy clubs. It was McKelvey's, Wits End, and the Comedy Works. And they wouldn't give you, you know, they weren't giving me no guest sets or nothing. I was just fighting for my fucking life. But I was doing a lot of drugs. I was fucking out every night. You know, I had a girlfriend after a while. Then she moved away and I was single again. And I just went off the deep end. And then in December that, because I pretty much, that broker mm-hmm. that I did comedy at, I just took it over. They had a hotel there. I would get free rooms. I would go in there and eat lunch for free every day. You know, I just took it. They made the best Rice Krispie treats you ever had in your life. And they had them for lunch.
That does sound good.
On the fucking buffet. So I would go in there every day and eat. I was just causing pandemonium in that place. And finally, one night, on a Tuesday night in December, a manager said something to me. And I looked him straight in the face. I'm like, do me a favor. Go fuck yourself. And he's like, what did you say? And there was like, before you got into the bar, there was a lounge that had a lot of books that you could sit there and get a brandy and just read a book if you want to. Who the fuck goes to a bar to read a book? But you know how people are, these fucking Gentiles. So I looked at him and I pushed him and he fucking knocked over a thing of books and I got fired from my open mic gig. But I gave him 14 good months. It was my first comedy job. So I was making money from day one in fucking comedy.
Yeah.
I pushed him. I was barely making ends meet at that time. You know, I was living in my friend's house in a room. I was paying child support. And my attorney fees were just starting to go through the fucking roof. And then I did Christmas. I did New Year's. I totaled my car. I didn't total my car. I fucked up the rim. But it was one of those cars where each rim was $1,200. Mm-hmm. So I actually had to go to the lot. I'm not going to say the lot because then people will know. I had to go to the lot in the middle of the winter, in the dead of January. I had to go to the lot, jack up a car, steal the tire off it to replace my fucking rim. You know, I was just living like a nomad then. I remember going home one Saturday night and I bought that new car. I didn't buy a new car. I bought a slightly used car. Like, you know, after you get divorced, you give away your truck and the family car, and you buy a hot rod. I bought an Acura Integra.
Okay.
Beautiful, with a tremendous sound system. And I financed it through this bank. And I had a bank account at this bank. You know, the whole fucking deal. And one night I go home, and I'm dead broke. I got no dough. And I got to do a line of coke. And I found that, you know, this any credit card, when you get a credit card, they send you those blank checks.
Yeah.
And Discover, I had like three Discover checks. And that bank had a 24-hour drive-through. And I just wrote a check for $1,000 to cash. The Discover card was closed, for Christ's sake. The Discover card had been taken from me already. I gave the lady a check and she cashed it.
No.
They gave me $1,000 fucking Monday morning. Monday morning, 9:01, they called me. And they said, if we don't have our money by 5 o'clock, we're going to press charges on you. I didn't have the fucking money.
Yeah,
I had spent the money in an hour. So I went down to the bank and cut a deal with them to add it on to the car principal. And then I didn't make the car payment for 3 fucking months. And that was great when a tow truck is following you and you see them following
yeah,
you. So you got to hide your car like Rambo with camouflage and fucking trees and shit.
You got to shake them and shit, yeah.
You know, when you look back, you think of all this shit, you're like, what the fuck was I thinking? Why would I even stick it out with something that there's no money in? Like, there was no money in comedy back then.
No.
I was just doing comedy. I was just loving it. And I was getting on stage every night, and I finally had a call. My brother, whose wife just recently died about 2 months ago after I got here, I called him. I told him what my situation was. I told him I couldn't make rent, that I was losing the war with my wife, with the kid, you know. And he sent me a plane ticket back to Jersey. He goes, come back. So I came back, whatever that date was, for the Super Bowl. I was back in Jersey. But before I left, I went to the Valium guy, and I fronted like 10,000 Valiums.
Jesus.
I told him I'd be back in an hour. I told him I'd be back in an hour, and I brought the Valiums back here with me to start my comedy career up here as finance. So that's where we'll leave off. January of 93.
I'm writing it down. Hold on. January 1993 is where we pick up. I love you, brother. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me, brother. Always a pleasure to see you. I miss you with all my heart.
I miss you too.
You know, I'm not mad at Los Angeles. Like I told my wife today, we went to lunch. And I go, I'm not mad. A lot of great things happened for me in L.A. And I got to meet a lot of great people, and you're one of them. So
thank you, brother.
Thank you. And I'm happy we continue the saga.
We'll keep it going whenever you're available, my friend.
So I couldn't really go off.
Yeah, we'll wrap it up.
next time we do this, I'll cover the fucking holes in this story. There's more excitement in this story, but I got the FBI upstairs. So.
I love you, brother. As always.
November 25th. November 25th, Ozzy's Boneyard.
All right.
12 o'clock Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. And then every day after that till the 30th, the Boneyard plays. Hopefully they'll keep me and they'll let me do one show a week, and I could do my heavy metal stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know it, brother. That's great. Good for you. Well, I love you.
That's what we're trying to do.
We'll
I love you, brother.
Soon.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.
Thank you for having me on the Honeydew. A shout out to all you Patreon motherfuckers. I love you. And that's it.
All right, as always, RyanSickler.com, Ryan Sickler on all social media. We'll talk to you all next week.